The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. I'm Anthony Skinner, producer of the show, and we are happy to have you here today. We have part two of our two-part series with John Mark Comer. He is the author of My Name is Hope, Loveology, Garden City, God Has a Name, and his latest book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. He is also the pastor for Teaching and Vision at Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon, where he lives, works, and writes. He is an Enneagram 1. So let's pick back up in our conversation with Ian and John Mark as they discuss Enneagram and how in growth and maturity, your vice actually becomes your virtue. So here we are with John Mark Comer and your host, Ian Cron.
Do you remember in The Great Divorce, there's that famous scene that Lewis writes, just it's amazing, right? Where the guy has this little sulfur-spitting demon on his shoulder and the angel says, you know, we got to kill that thing, you know what I mean? And he's like, oh no, I can't live without it. He goes, oh well, you know, if we kill that thing, you can come with me into the kingdom. And he's like, I can't live without it. And the little demon's going, you can't live without me, you can't live without me. And then finally, the guy lets the angel kill that demon on his shoulder. And what happens? The demon turns into a beautiful horse.
Wow.
And the guy rides off into the kingdom on it. And I think that is such a great illustration of what you just said, which is like, if you can allow God to, if you will, kill off the false self of our personality styles, vice, and you know what I mean? It can actually turn into the horse that you ride off into with glory. So literally, the vice of resentment and anger, when it is, let's get right to it. Once it's dead, can be resurrected into something called serenity, which you can ride off on into glory.
Wow, that's amazing. And to be, that's like so inspiring to hear that. This is going to be a good day. It's 7 a.m. for those of you listening on West Coast time. Ian was not very thoughtful for a Pacific Northwester. And, well, dang you, Ian Cron.
Well, we aim to please here at Typology. We aim to please.
Hey, you know, one of the lines that I feel God keeps bringing to my heart that actually came through an interesting experience. Number of years ago, probably 5 years ago now, I did inner healing prayer with my community, actually, which I don't know if you're familiar with that or that's a part of your repertoire practice, but kind of healing and memories would be another name for it, where you just kind of go back with a couple of people and there's a person in our community that was trained for it, and you revisit past memories and wounds and ask where God was and ask for God's voice over it, and you're essentially looking for some kind of inner emotional healing of memories. And I have a pretty happy childhood, come from a really healthy, not perfect, but really healthy family of origin. But the memory that almost immediately the Spirit brought me back to was this memory with my mom, my mom is my hero. She's kind of who I want to be when I grow up. So I have a great relationship with her. But I must have been, it was when we lived in a house that we lived there from 6 to 10. So somewhere in the 6 to 10 range. I don't remember when. And I, from a young age, could not fall asleep at night because I couldn't turn my brain off. Through grade school, I just could not fall asleep. And so the way that my mom would get me to fall asleep, she'd come into my room and she would smooth out my bedspread perfectly. I would lay in my back and she'd smooth out the bedspread perfectly, no wrinkles. She'd tuck it in on the sides and it would be just perfect. And she'd give me a kiss goodnight. And then I so did not want to mess up the bedspread. I wanted it to stay perfectly straight, that I would lay perfectly still, and that's how I would fall asleep. And you know, she had no malevolent intent. She was just trying to help me sleep and be a loving mother. But I thought, oh my gosh, what does that say about me? What 6-year-old can't sleep until their bedspread is perfectly tucked in, you know? And the phrase that I felt in the, when I came back to that memory that I felt from the spirit was just, it doesn't have to be perfect to have peace. And that's the phrase that I will just bring to mind every single day. It doesn't have to be perfect to have peace. It's that tree imagery, you know, in the wind. Like, things can be all over the place and a mess and imperfect, and I can still be stabilitas, at peace, happy in the kingdom, you know?
Yeah, man. Well, that's because, you know, the world is full of unmade beds.
Okay. The world is an unmade bed, Ian Cron.
That's right. It is. The world is an unmade bed. And so we, that's the acceptance of reality that ones kind of have to get to, right? It's like, hey, the world is full of unmade beds, but that doesn't negate the possibility of my being at peace in it.
Yep.
Right? That's pretty beautiful. You were saying earlier that you kind of have gone through an existential crisis lately with the Enneagram. You mentioned that before we got started.
Oh, yeah. In fact, existential crisis over being on this podcast. My lovely wife, last night we're on a date, and she's like, what are you doing in the morning? I'm like, oh, I have an early morning podcast with Typology, and she loves your show. And she thought, wait, what? She was like shocked that I would come on, because for the last year, I've been in this like existential crisis with Enneagram, and I haven't been telling people my number for the last year or so, but it's with like a low level of commitment because I still have all sorts of questions. So yeah, I think, like I said, I got into Enneagram maybe 8 years ago, and it was before it was more popularized through the work of people like yourself and others, which we're so grateful for. And so I'd never heard of it. None of my friends were into it. It was just like me and my therapist. And, you know, I think I gave a book to my wife early on. And we started spreading it around our church and such. But I hate, and I still love Enneagram, but I really struggle with how it's been weaponized. And I really don't, like I said earlier, don't enjoy it as a theory of personality for interpersonal relationships. Just personally, I like some of the other ones. I don't, and I think that could just be my oneness in that I'm so bent to see what's wrong. And I don't want to interpret like if a 7 says to me, you know, let's have another glass of wine or whatever, I don't want to interpret that as they're running from the pain of their wound or whatever. I'd love to just say, oh, this is a fun person and let's be together, you know, or whatever. I don't want to interpret malevolent intent toward me or others. I don't want to see the negativity in somebody unless if it's, you know, a really close personal relationship that I will see that side of them either way, and it helps me to cultivate compassion. But I remember, and you know way more about this than me, but my understanding, so tell me if I'm way off here, my understanding was that for many years in the Jesuit tradition, that it was used, the Enneagram was used between a spiritual director and spiritual directee, and often the director would not even tell the directee what the Enneagram was or what their number was. They would just have this framework. They would get to know the person, and they would say, oh, I bet you Ian's a 4. And they would just use that framework to kind of help the person pray and grow into maturity. And then maybe if and when they thought the person was mature enough to handle, because there's a lot. People use it in weird ways. They use it in identity ways. They can use it in victim mentality. They can excuse behavior, you know, when they don't use it well or when I don't use it well. When they thought they were mature enough, they would say, hey, there's this thing called the Enneagram, and I think you would identify as a type whatever, you know? And then my understanding is, then you're not allowed to tell other people your number because it's an intensely private thing. So I will never forget when I asked my spiritual director, who was a Jesuit priest, hey, what's your Enneagram number? And I'm pretty sure he was a 5 and da-da-da-da. You would have thought I just asked him like a horribly inappropriate question about his sexuality or how much money he made that year or, you know what I mean? Like something just totally, like, you don't ask people, who did you vote for in the last election or whatever? Well, I guess we ask each other now. But he just literally leaned up against the back wall, covered his like arms over and looked down at his feet and said, I'm sorry, we don't say. So I thought that was ridiculous at first, but I guess now, a few years in, I see some of the wisdom of that. But maybe I'm crazy. So tell me what you. So I guess I'm wrestling with that. Like, do I want everybody to know my deepest, darkest motivations? And in particular, as a pastor, people project all sorts of stuff onto you, projections, like one of the main things I deal with as a leader. So people are already projecting their father or some bad experience they had with the man or whatever onto me. I don't know if I wanted them to project oneness onto me too.
Yeah.
But I'm clearly, it's an open question in my mind, hence here I am having this conversation. So can you give me a little free therapy?
Sure.
And can you educate me a little bit here?
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, some of the history you're describing is absolutely true. That's the provenance of the Enneagram, that it was originally used in spiritual direction between Catholic priests and novices, or between spiritual directors and directees. There was more hesitancy around talking too much about type and knowing each other's types. I think, you know, the Enneagram can be approached from at least two different perspectives. One would be from a purely psychological perspective. So
right.
At that level, the rules change, right? You're far more forthcoming.
If that makes sense.
In the religious setting, the treatment of the instrument would be approached very differently.
Because you're talking more about the sin aspect of each.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, and now remember, if your spiritual director actually is a five, of course they might respond by saying, "I don't talk about that."
you just weaponized it. Come on.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
You just interrupted and entered my space. And,
you know. I mean, it might have been. You know, if you ask me that question, I'm happy to talk about it. But a five.
Oh, I know. It's like when people say, "Oh, I don't identify with a number Enneagram." I'm like, "Oh, that must mean you're a four."
Right.
Because you don't want to be pegged down, which is my immaturity when I think that.
But you know. But here's the thing. There is some value to it in that regard, because, you know, if you and again, it all depends on how you hold the information. If you hold it with a light grip and you say, John Mark, maybe he's a one. And knowing that he's a one, I'm going to be curious about him. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to put this template or this grid over him, you know. I'm just going to keep this in the back of my mind because I want to know how best to love John Mark.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have to turn that into an overt conversation, right? It's just in the back of my mind. I'm thinking, how can I best serve his interests spiritually, psychologically? How do I support him in his journey toward transformation? And so I just have it as a little data point floating around in the back of my brain, you know?
Yeah.
I think it can help in interpersonal relationships for sure if it's held well. You know, it's all about what's your posture toward this information.
Yeah.
So one of the things I tell people all the time is, just because you know my number doesn't mean you know me.
Yes. That's well said.
So it's just a point. It's a way of saying, well, there is a dimension of Ian's person that seems to fall into this constellation or this suite of behaviors and ways of seeing the world. That sounds like an Enneagram 1. It's a low resolution picture of what it's like to be Ian. It's not the fullness of who Ian is, but it's a dimension of him that maybe I should keep in the back of my mind. And what it does is it gives me a way to communicate and to be with Ian in a way that will, create the possibility of his becoming a better Ian.
Yeah. Me enjoy it. I think the problem for me, that's so well said, is I think it takes an enormous amount of psychological and spiritual maturity to handle it the way that you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it takes a lot of relational dexterity. I loved how you said hold it lightly and recognize it's not a full picture who he is. I just think that takes an enormous amount of maturity. And the problem is now Enneagram is out and it's running wild through our churches and cities, which is kind of great, but through people across the maturity spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if you don't have that kind of mental dexterity and emotional maturity, it's just so easy to weaponize, you know?
Sounds like Christianity.
Yeah. Sounds like atonement theory. We should only give it to people that are like, really mature. Only after you've reached a certain level of psychological maturity will we help you actually explain the death and resurrection.
Well, you know, people used to say to me all the time, like, well, you know, the Enneagram. I went on the internet and, you know, oh, there's a lot of crazy things about the Enneagram. I go, oh, yeah? Just throw Jesus in the search field and see what comes up.
Google history of the Western Church and see what comes.
Yeah, you'll get some weirdness. but you're right.
That's the best answer anybody could possibly give right there.
Well, but you know the thing is, right? Is we can take anything that's good and distort it, and you know you have to ask yourself, well, is it better to let it loose and let it do its good where it does it, or do we keep it to ourselves to some small clique, like a Gnostic cult around the Enneagram? I'm like, well.
And what, it was cultish early on. I mean, it definitely sounds to me like kind of cultish for a couple of kids there.
Oh, yeah. And so I feel like, you know, I do a lot of re-education. You do a lot of re-education in your job. I do a lot of re-education in my job to try and get people to have the healthiest sort of expression of their work, their personal, psychological, and spiritual work. You do the same in your role as a pastor. You know, we're always going around trying to, you know, sweep the street of all the kookiness, you know, and try to give people the best version of what that, from our perspective, can be had, you know?
So that's so well said. Maybe that's just, again, back to my chronic need to control things to make it all right, you know?
Yep.
And the way that I just have to release that and let that go. Let go of outcomes.
Yeah.
And just, what is this?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I completely agree. I think to say there's only one right way for this thing to be used, it would probably be kind of limiting because, you know.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that at all. I was just more thinking for my own personal.
Yeah.
Not some like agenda for Enneagram in the world.
No,
because that's the irony is I want you to have a podcast interviewing other ones so I can listen.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen.
But I just don't want everybody to know that I'm a one.
Too late. Roughly about 500,000 people this month are going to know you're a one. So listen,
irony of it. My wife was like, wait, you're doing what in the morning? She's like, you went from not telling anybody your number for like a year and a half to you're going on a podcast that has lots of listeners. I'm like, well, I need to process my crap.
That's right. You said, well, that's my nine wing, baby.
Yeah.
So,
oh man, that nine wing is something fierce.
Oh, it's a good thing though. So listen, you've got a new book. It's called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, How to Stay Emotionally Healthy and Spiritually Alive in the Chaos of the Modern World. It just dropped a couple of weeks ago.
Even got the subtitle in. Yeah, just a couple of weeks.
All right. I have never heard a title of a book that is more unlike a one than...
Oh, really?
The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. Because
serenity, man, we're on the path to serenity.
Yeah, well, yeah, but like, so that ruthless elimination of hurry, you know, ones are notorious for never stopping, for constantly, you know, rushing around, trying to fix the world. Everything they see is sort of a beckoning to work, to not stopping. So
indexing the windows, all things.
Right, and so I'm just curious, and I, you know, you've kind of answered the question in our conversation already, which is, you know, you've done a lot of work on yourself. So, but you know, your typical one, the idea that you could eliminate hurry, it's just not part of the typically of the disposition or the temperament of the one. It's very hard for them to stop hurrying. So, I guess tell me about the book, and then how it is that you have begun as a one to eliminate hurry in your life.
So the book is built around a conversation between Dallas Willard, who is kind of my, you know, I feel like every pastor has some thinker in church history that they've built their theological and spiritual paradigm around. So you read a Tim Keller book and you don't get more than two pages in without a C.S. Lewis quote. You know, for other people, it's Luther or Bonhoeffer or whoever. For me, you know, I think it's just Willard. His writings have done more to shape the way that I follow Jesus than really anybody that I'm aware of since the New Testament. And he once said to John Ortberg, who's another pastor and writer, generation ahead of me, hero of mine that I get to spend some time with on a regular basis. So John told me this story a number of years ago, and he's since put it in a few of his books. But Willard just told John that hurry is the great enemy of spiritual life in our day, and then said you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And there's a whole rabbit trail, whole book, but there's all sorts of things in that that really I just felt a deep resonance with in my soul, and have really come to the conviction that hurry is incompatible with love. If the telos of the spiritual journey is to become a person of love, and how I would define spiritual life, which is such sentimental language that people throw around inside and outside of the church, that I don't think it has a lot of like mental traction anymore. So I would just define spiritual life as our capacity to receive and give love in relationship to God and other people. And at that level, hurry is essentially incompatible with a life of love. And as I think about it, all of my most unloving moments, all of my worst moments are as a husband, father, friend, pastor, are when I'm in a hurry. And, you know, the nature of hurry is not a lot to do. There's a healthy aspect of just I'm giving my life away, but it's just too much to do. And so the only way to cram it all in is you speed up your mind, your body, your relationships and interactions with other people to this insane pace that becomes 100% incongruent with love. Love is patient. That's Paul's first thing on the list, you know. There's a Japanese theologian, Kosuke Kiyama, that I love. He has this little book called 3 Mile an Hour God. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that or read that. Great title. I had to Google it. I'm like, 3 mile an hour, God, what is that? Apparently 3 miles an hour is the speed of walking. And he has this essay on love, and it's so good. It's the title for that book. And he basically just makes the point that, you know, God, we talk about walking with God, not running with God. And he just has this line that God walks slowly because he is love. And if he was not love, he would go much faster. But how love has this speed, this inner spiritual speed that's slow. And, you know, at a psychological level, you know, they tell us that, as you know, that listening well and attention and compassion is virtually indistinguishably loving. Even if you fully disagree with what's being said, if you feel listened to and attended to, you feel loved by a person. And love is painfully time consuming. All interpersonal relationships are painfully time consuming. So, yeah, I mean, I think in my own autobiography, I was that person that was insane, workaholic, up late, driver, ambitious, go, go, go. And I just was an unkind, critical, mean person. Not that I'm all that's out of my body yet, but it just hit me really hard. Oh, well, I can't live a life of speed and become a person of love and joy and peace. And so, you know, the book has really come out of that story and my, and then the, so it's aspirational idea. Most people hear that and say, oh, yeah, that sounds great. I want to be happier and more loving and not so rushed. But how in the world do you do that with an iPhone and a family and a job and I live in a city, like all the stuff, you know? So the book is also a ton of just practices from the way of Jesus, like Sabbath, quiet, stillness, contemplative prayer, that help slow us down and help us live from like a deep inner kind of serenity and calm and peaceful awareness to what is as we go through the chaos of life and family and parenting and work and the digital age, you know?
Well, I can think of, I mean, it sounds beautiful. I can't wait to read it after you send me a signed copy. one of the things that I just as you were talking, I was thinking, wow, what a great book for, you know, every single type on the Enneagram. But for different reasons. Twos could be running around rushing to help others.
Make everybody happy and do everything and do all the things that need to be needed.
Right. And you know, threes for obvious reasons, achievers, for sixes and sevens and eights in particular. Those numbers come to mind very, very quickly. But particularly for ones, what you were describing, I love what you were saying that you know, if you can learn to live in a different space than hurry, then you can find this love and this peace and this serenity that is really what you're after. you know?
Yeah.
And so obviously to ones who are listening, there is a book written by someone who understands you. It is called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. And I promise you, even though I haven't read it, just based on this conversation, it will be of great value to every type. But ones, listen carefully, because interestingly enough, John Mark, the two numbers that probably listen to our show and read my book and other things that more than any other types are nines and ones.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That, okay, the one doesn't surprise me at all, because we're bent toward self-improvement.
Right.
Because everything has room for improvement. But why the nine?
You know, I don't know.
And my wife loves your show.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
she identifies as a nine.
You know, I think nines have the potential to be the most spiritually evolved number on the Enneagram.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that they are...
Is that because they have access to so many of the... They can be so well-rounded kind of thing? So.
Yeah, I think fives and nines are probably the most natural mystics on the Enneagram.
Yeah.
Fives make great Zen Buddhists, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're because of that sort of... And it's not a great feature of them. They... Because of... Well, it's actually not... I mean, the Buddhists would actually not probably use the word detachment as much as non-attachment.
Yeah.
But and so I think health for a five is to move from detachment to non-attachment.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. That's well said.
I think nines are naturally bent, when they're healthy, towards non-attachment, toward... they have a very diffuse attention, so they pick up a lot in the environment, sometimes too much. They can be a little bit like one of those little critters. I hate to use the word slug, but that's what it is, that when it gets wet, it just kind of blows up. You know, it's so
Interesting.
It's so porous.
It's
just taking in too much. I think that can happen with nines, and I think that's why...
Yeah, my wife is like that.
Yeah, they can... That's why they start to narcotize or check out. It's just too much.
It's too much to take in.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whereas a three...
But yeah, I mean, she is incredibly aware, spiritually, socially, psychologically. When she doesn't check out, she's in that space, but without my criticism, moral judgment of everything. She can more take it in without moralizing like I do.
Right. Just accepting it as it is. It just is.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
No judgment, no analysis, no pre-existing biases being brought to the table.
Yes, which I bring all of that.
Oh, me too. Me too. Right. Now, interestingly, about your wife, who is a nine, you told me that that was a recent discovery for her and that it was pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting. So again, we got into Enneagram maybe 7-8 years ago. I got into it first, then gave her the book. She read Roar's book, and this is before there was podcasts and stuff that we knew of. And she identified as a two right away, and has sat with that for, I don't know, 5 years or whatever, 6 years. And then last summer, through a series of events, basically she realized that she had mistyped herself, and she realized that she was a nine. And now she just regularly will say to me, "What was I thinking? How do I possibly think that I was a two?" And she has chronic health issues. She has Lyme disease, which has been a great part of our story and our formation, and even forcing me and her to both accept reality, you know. And I think a lot of, you know, she would say, well, I don't identify with some of the industriousness of the two, I think because I'm unwell or because I'm tired all the time. And then now she's realizing a lot of what she blamed on her disease is just her nineness. <You know? laughs> So she was like devastated when I remember last summer she went into almost a depression for a month because she, all this stuff that she's like, well, I'm just tired, I have chronic health. And she's like, yes, but actually I just check out and don't want to be present
because
it's painful.
Well, I mean, that's
but beautiful. It was like, I mean, it's so funny. It was like it caused this stir in our family and community. And like when a millennial re-identifies as a different type, I feel like that's when a baby boomer, like when a Protestant would become Catholic or something. It was just like the scandal. It's not actually a scandal. They still love Jesus and follow Jesus, but it's like, no, you can't do that. So it was all the talk of our little circle of friends for a couple of months last summer.
That is fantastic.
That's hilarious.
Wow.
But it's been really actually amazing to see. I mean, as she's been sitting with that for the last year, it's been enormously helpful for her and her growth, and just her realizing how much she does check out. And she, the last 6 months, has been more present than she ever has.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. That is the most common mistype I see is nines and twos.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. And there's a reason for it that we won't go into, but maybe at some later date. But it's a very common mistype.
I want to ask you why, but I guess we got to stay in the one vein.
Well, actually, we got to stay in the time thing, man. Because
now, how you say ones and nines are your most common listeners. What's your opinion on the? And I don't think there's any empirical data yet, or maybe there is by now. Do you think that ones really are the least common type, as so many people say, or
no? Fours are the least. I mean, we speculate that fours are the least represented in the population, and that sixes are the most. There are more sixes than any other type. The second type that we see or that people speculate is sort of number two represented in the population is nines.
So there's a lot of sixes and nines. A
lot of sixes and nines.
Yeah, you know, because I've heard that my whole life, and I've just – or not life, my since the whole time I've been around Enneagram, but like my own church experience doesn't – like there's a lot of ones in our church. And there's hardly any sixes. I probably know less sixes than anybody. And I've always tried to figure out, is that an urban thing? Is that sixes don't migrate towards cities? Is that a church thing? Is that they just disappear? Is that – I know a ton of nines. Now that you think about it, I would probably know more nines in our church than anybody else.
You know, it's interesting. When I do workshops, the number that's least represented at it almost every single time is sixes.
Yeah.
And I think, well, first of all, I think sixes have to take the longest amount of time. This may be an overstatement. I'd have to think about it more. But sixes have the hardest time identifying their type. In fact, if someone says to me, you know, what type has the hardest time figuring out its type? And I always go sixes. It's just sort of part of their ambivalence. The lack of confidence sometimes sixes have in their decision making ability. It's like they're almost afraid to self-diagnose.
Yeah, that anxiety. Yeah.
Yeah. And also they don't show up, I think, at a lot of things because there is that anxiety. Like, well, what is this? And who is the guy teaching it? Is he, you know, is they as the authority figure, is that person trustworthy?
And is this an Eastern cult? And what is this? And it looks like the pentagram. And
right.
Yeah.
Or but there yeah, I mean six is, you know, for whatever reason they're even hard to get on the show, because they're hard to sort of figure out who they are, and they don't naturally raise their hand and say, "I'm a six, I want to be on your show." Threes all the time are sending me press kits, you know. I want to be on your show. I got a new book coming out, you know. Or you know, sevens want to be on because it's going to be a really fun conversation.
It's just going to be a fun time.
Yeah. And nines love to come on, but I do have a harder time with ones. Fives, sixes, getting those types on the show is a little bit more difficult.
So you have a lot of one listeners, but they don't like to come on the show.
You know, I mean, we had a one on who's a dear friend not too long ago, and she was like, "I just sort of stayed up last night preparing for this." I mean, it's like they want to do it perfectly. They just want to get it right, and so it creates a lot of anxiety to be on the show, and they get like, oh, you know, I don't know if I want to.
And it's exposure, all your stuff in front of all these people.
All that. So we're in this sort of Thanksgiving season, and so I have a question for you, but I'm going to go first. And the question is, you know, at this time of year, you know, what are you, at this point in your spiritual journey, most thankful for? Like, what is it that just brings up a well of gratitude in you? And actually, I won't go first. You go first. You tell me what that is for you right now.
Oh, man. I feel like maybe I should give a really spiritual answer. But honestly, we just moved a year ago, and we've lived in the city for many years, which we love urban living and all of that. But we Portland is built up against Forest Park, which is the largest urban forested park in America. It's 5,000 acres, and it abuts literally to downtown. So you go right from like six-story apartment buildings to just forest. And it's untouched, and it's beautiful, and it's always been my place to go run and walk and experience some serenity and come to peace. So long story short, we were able to get a house that abuts right up against the forest. So we're right kind of in the city, but our backyard is like looks out basically on 5,000 acres. You know, you don't see it all, but you just look out into the forest. You see nothing but forest. And that combined with, I think, some of the inner work that the Spirit of God has been doing in me to just slowly, very slowly, but surely bring me toward serenity. Mm. When those two things come together, external serenity with internal serenity in moments of morning prayer, or contemplation, or a Sabbath where I'm just sitting there on the back deck reading poetry or whatever, it's like I couldn't be more happy and alive. Just to be at peace in nature, for me, I mean, that's to be at peace with God in a beautiful, quiet place. I can't really think of anything that I'm more grateful for. Lots of great things happening. I have a book out, and the church is doing well, and blah, blah, blah. Honestly, that stuff's like so far down the band. I just want to like sit in the quiet in the forest and enjoy God and my family, you know? Mm. That's what I'm really grateful for.
Wow, that's beautiful. I am, honestly, and I'm not saying this because it's a great wrap for our conversation, I am grateful that I get to, this is my, that as a job, I get to talk to interesting people and answer important questions, or at least, or at least try. You know what I
mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
What a gift to like just hang out with people and hear about their journey, to hear about the mystery of their life, and then also to just get paid to answer interesting questions about life. You know, at least from my perspective, I'm not saying the answer is always right, but at least to kind of like have to sit and wrestle with them. And
yeah,
and this conversation is an example of that gift to me, you know.
Yeah.
So thank you so much.
And what a joy that the gift to you is a gift to the rest of us too.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's so helpful, the things you're saying. I'm just so, I feel like I'm getting free therapy right now. You know, like, well, seriously, I mean, it's just so, so helpful.
Well, the meter's running, and we are sending you a bill.
Send me a bill afterwards.
And I don't take insurance. The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, How to Save, Stay Emotionally Healthy and Spiritually Alive in the Chaos of the Modern World is John Mark's new book. I want to strongly commend it to every type on the Enneagram, but Enneagram 1s, this guy, I'm just sure his voice is going to speak into your life in particular. John Mark, thank you for being on with us, and I hope that we have a face-to-face one day at one of these speaking gigs we're at together.
Yes. Absolutely. Or if you're ever in Portland, you look me up. Coffee's on me, or Powell's. Let me peruse Powell's with you, and we'll get some good books, fellow literary fan that we are.
Yes. Hey, everybody. I want you to remember the words of the great Oscar Wilde. Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken.